Yada, I'm Erica Wilkinson, and this is the Doc Sounds of Science podcast. Kia ora, ko Erica Wilkinson tēnei. He kona I pirangi tēnei e pa ana ki ngā Sounds of Science. Every episode, we talk about work being done behind the scenes by Doc's technical experts, scientists, rangers, and the experts in between. Kia ora koutou katoa, hello to you all. I'm very excited to welcome to the show the world's most renowned kākāpō scientist, Dr. Andrew Digby. Kia ora, Andrew.
Kia ora, Erica. It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming. Andrew is an expert in all things kākāpō. You may know him from the artist formerly known as Twitter, where he offers behind-the-scenes insights into the worlds of kākāpō and takahe. Andrew's social media promise is come for the videos, stay for the science, and that is exactly what we're doing today. Let's talk about the science of kākāpō recovery. Would you like to introduce yourself to our lovely listeners, Andrew?
Yeah, sure. Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Andrew Digby ohau, ko te kaitohu tohu pūteo o kākāpō me takahe o te papa atawhai e mahi ana. So I am Andrew Digby, and I'm the science advisor for kākāpō and takahe with the Department of Conservation.
Kia ora. Is that just the coolest job in the world? I mean, it's doc and then it's kākāpō and takahe. Tell us about your role at Te Papa Atawhai.
Yeah, I think I'm very, very lucky get to look after and help look after these amazing birds. So I'm responsible for the science component of both of those recovery programs with the Department of Conservation. So helping to understand what it is that we don't know and how do we find it out.
That's huge. That's a big responsibility. How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, so I come from a slightly different background. I used to be an astronomer. I've ended up switching careers to conservation biology. I did a PhD with Kiwi and kind of came into this role after that. So I'm not kind of the traditional conservation person. I come from a little bit of a different background, which I think sometimes helps.
Yeah, definitely. And astronomy, it seems like such a change of path. And you're not a Kiwi by the sounds of it.
Yeah, no, I grew up in the UK and studied there, lived in America for a while and came to New Zealand about 18 years ago.
And didn't leave?
No, and didn't leave. This is home now.
And what does an average day entail for you in your work now?
Yeah, it's probably a cliched answer, but there's no such thing as an average day. It really depends. Quite a lot of the time, I'm behind a desk helping to manage our programs. I'm analyzing data, that sort of thing. But also quite a bit of the time that the part I really, really love is getting out to the field, getting my boots on, getting out onto the islands or into the mountains and then, doing the mahi on the ground.
What's the most unexpected thing you've encountered in the field?
Most unexpected thing? I think seeing groups of kākāpō has been quite unusual to see. We've always traditionally thought of kākāpō as solitary animals and birds, they just live by themselves. But we are seeing more and more often now kākāpō in groups. And, you know, I've seen, if we found a couple of juveniles in the same hole, I've seen two birds in the same tree. Some of our team have seen up to five birds in the same tree. So, yeah, that's definitely a case of that we're learning more and more about them. And what we thought was the case is actually not true. And as we start to restore kākāpō to their more natural numbers, we're actually beginning to see some of these behaviours which are normal, but we didn't think they were.
Okay, so they're not solitary. And what I've heard that the kind of younger ones in breeding season might hang out all together.
Yeah, that's right. They can actually, the teenage kākāpō really can behave a little bit like human teenagers sometimes, or some human teenagers. They can be pretty noisy at night. They muck around. If you're trying to sleep in a tent, they will be, I've had like four or five juvenile males around the tent all making noises. They'll be like peeking out from behind trees, pretending, practicing booming, climbing around the tent, just making a bit of a nuisance of themselves really. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty endearing to see.
That's the best way to lose sleep ever. That sounds amazing. Now, most of our listeners will know what kākāpō are, though flightless green parrot, endemic, endangered, but few will have seen one. I have never seen one. What might immediately stand out to someone encountering a kākāpō for the first time?
Yeah, I think there's two things. One is the camouflage. One is just how hard they are to see when you see them in the natural setting in the bush. I've stood 2 meters from a kākāpō. I was able to smell it, but I couldn't see it. I was actively looking for it, but could not see it. And it was literally 2 meters away. The camouflage is that good. So I think that's number one. And number two is the size. Most people, when they see a kākāpō for the first time, the first thing they always say is, oh, it's much bigger than I thought it would be. And they are big birds. So, you know, you can get up to 4 kilograms for a male, and they're quite a decent size, especially when you're like holding one on your lap, doing a health check or something like that.
I have two questions from that. How big, what ball size are we talking?
Yeah, so they'll be, if they're standing on the ground, they'll be just below sort of knee height sort of thing. Yeah, so they'll kind of be 50 centimeters long as well. So, and yeah, a few kilograms. And they've got very big claws too, so it kind of makes them look a little bit bigger as well.
And what do they smell like to you?
The smell one's interesting. It's so hard to describe smells, but everyone always says musty, which kind of is true. They have a really sweet smell. So the males in breeding season are the ones that smell the strongest, and it's quite a floral sort of smell, a little bit earthy. Yeah, not a bad smell at all, quite a nice smell, and it's really strong. So as you're walking along a track, you will be able to smell a kakapo, which is nearby. And that's humans with our rubbish noses. So Yeah. So the scent is really unique. It's quite, and it's really, really strong.
And I know everybody loves kakapo, but what do you most like about it? What draws you to this species?
I like, sorry, this is me putting my scientist hat on. I like that they don't follow the rules, that they're different. Pretty much every time we study something about kakapo, that we find out they're just different to every other bird, and often most other mammals as well. So, you know, for example, we've done some work on vitamin D, and the use of vitamin D and the role of vitamin D in kakapo seems to be completely different from any other vertebrate as we understand it. It's like, and we're looking at aging kakapo and all the rules that you have of how to age birds and different tests you can do. They don't work on kakapo. So there's, you know, lots and lots of examples. Every time we study something new about them, we find out, yep, they just do not follow the rules.
And can they look after themselves?
Yeah, they can. They can definitely hold their own. They're actually probably a little bit fiercer than you might think. I've seen a female kakapo kill a petrel in front of my eyes. Well, it was on a video feed from a nest, but that often happens if they tend to share nests or burrows. So a petrel will be trying to roost where a kakapo has nested, and the kakapo doesn't like a petrel coming into its nest, and the fighting is quite ferocious. They'll use their claws and their bill, and they will quickly dispatch the petrel. The problem from a conservation point of view is that in the nest often there'll be some quite delicate eggs, and when there's a big fight going on, then they tend to get broken. So yeah, that causes issues. But yeah, they can definitely hold their own, and they will hold their own against people as well. So we have some individuals which will be defend their nest pretty robustly against people. So it's always a good idea to wear pretty strong gaiters when you're going to a kakapo nest of those ones, those particular individuals too, to give yourself a bit of protection. I'll try and go for your shins and your knees.
So you've been attacked by a kakapo?
Yeah, I have been attacked by a few kakapo. Yeah. It's kind of a slightly unnerving experience. You have to just be as defensive as possible. Just don't hurt the kakapo or let them hurt you, and just get out of there as quickly as possible.
That's it. Oh my gosh. It's all for the good of conservation. You notice personality differences across chicks who were hand-reared and those who weren't?
Yeah, we do. So we try and hand-rear kakapo as little as possible, but sometimes it's necessary to save the life of that kakapo. And we do tend to notice that those kakapo which are hand-reared do not have a fear of humans as much. They tend not to like humans as much either. They tend to be the ones which are a little bit more aggressive. And so, for example, some of our founder kakapo, which are the original kakapo found on Rakiura, Stewart Island in Fiordland back in the 70s and 80s, they tend to be quite docile and quite calm. It seems like they don't actually recognize humans as a threat or a predator at all, whereas the hand-reared kakapo kind of know humans, and they kind of have learned not to like us very much. They're certainly not scared of us. So it does vary though a lot from between individuals too. So that's one of the crazy things I really notice about kakapo, is just the individual variation.
Gosh, that is the opposite of what I would have thought. I would have thought that the kind of hand-reared ones would be a bit more chilled around people, but no, they don't like you.
Yes, some are, but quite a few of them aren't, and they tend to be quite vocal and noisy. So we do notice a lot of differences, and it doesn't follow set rules, but they do, you know, there are these tendencies.
Okay. And what's the kind of weirdest or most interesting thing you've seen kakapo do?
I think the killing the seabird is quite a weird one. And so the males actually, when they're at their bowls, will also kill seabirds as well, kill petrels, which get close to their bowls too. Might possibly sometimes try and mate with the dead sea bird as well. But there's some crazy things going on. Another thing that springs to mind is that they're pretty fierce. We found a male who had pretty much been scalped by another kakapo in the last breeding season. They're territorial. They will defend their display sites, and they'll have some pretty robust fights. And we found one, his activity was low, so we went to check on him and pretty much lost all of the feathers and all of the skin from the top of his head. He had to go to hospital and recovered well. But we have had males kill each other too. We had one, bit another one's jugular and killed it, sort of thing. So yeah, they are robust. They're not necessarily the fluffy, docile things that they might appear to be, but when they need to, they can stick up for themselves.
Robust, not like the misleading marketing that we've been told. No, not the soft toy.
Yeah, that's right.
And you mentioned them trying to breed. The breeding is one of the biggest challenges, right? And it's quite unusual. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, the kakapo infertility is probably the biggest issue that we have. Or actually, it's not technically infertility, it's low hatching rate. So of about all of the eggs that are laid, only about half of them hatch into kakapo. And only about a third of them turn into kakapo, that fledge. So the productivity rate is really low. Normally in birds, that figure would be up at like 90% or something. Even with a species like takahe, which has been through a similar sort of genetic bottleneck, that's about 80% or so fertility. So kakapo have real problems with the fertility. We think it's mostly a genetic basis due to that inbreeding that they've had. So they've been through this tiny, tiny population bottleneck. There's not much genetic variation. So we think that's the cause. But there are other possibilities, for things like diet, for example, could possibly play into that fertility. So that's kind of why we're doing quite a lot of research to understand more about that and try and understand how to mitigate it. And one of the things that we've discovered recently is we think maybe population density may be affected by and may affect fertility as well. And so the more females there are, there seems to be some sort of mate guarding going on. The females, the more times a female mates, the more fertile her clutch is as well. So there's quite a lot of things that we're trying to understand to try and turn that around and try and improve that fertility.
Okay. Can you walk us through how the breeding season works and what your role is during that time?
Yeah, sure. So kakapo breeding seasons are a big deal. And one of the unusual things is that kakapo don't breed every year like most birds do. They only breed about every 2 to 4 years. And that's in response to the masting or the mass fruiting of certain tree species. So when it does happen, it's a really, really big deal. There are very few kakapo, so we want to make sure every single egg that's laid has got as much chance of surviving to a fully grown kakapo as possible. So we manage it very intensively. So we'll have teams on islands where kakapo are nesting, and we will set up a lot of electronic monitoring gear at the nests. So we have cameras at the nests, we'll have proximity detector sensors, we'll have data loggers, so we can tell remotely when the kakapo is at the nest, how long it's been there, what its activity is like on the nest, how well it's incubating, that sort of thing. So that's quite an intensive process. And we will monitor the eggs. We'll look after the eggs and make sure that they're fertile. If they're not fertile, we'll remove them. And then when the chicks hatch, we pay a lot of attention to the chicks. So depending on the value of the chick, we will weigh it sometimes every night, sometimes every 3 nights, sometimes every week, and we'll give it a health check. So that goes right throughout the whole process until the chick fledges around about 70 days old. So yeah, each nest gets a lot of attention, and we'll follow those chicks once they fledge. They'll hang out with their mother for quite a few months, and we'll follow them for about the next six months or so quite intensively. So that whole process from start to finish normally takes about a year or so. That includes things like artificial insemination, which we do to try and improve the fertility of kakapo, to try and improve the representation of some individuals which have never bred before. There's a lot of different facets to the breeding season. And my role is a bit of a mix. I'll kind of help manage that process and provide some technical oversight, but I'm also a pair of boots on the ground. I'm a ranger too. So love doing that. And the whole team does that. We all basically spend time on the islands. We're all out at nighttime checking nests, sleeping at tents up on the tops of islands near nests to look after the chicks and the eggs, that sort of thing. So it's, pretty much everyone just mucks in, and we all contribute pretty evenly.
Oh, that sounds like kind of a wonderful experience. What do you mean by the value of the chick? Do you mean how certain it is to survive?
No, actually, we have a bit of it might sound slightly mercenary, but we have to do this. So we have a scoring system for how valuable each chick is, and we base that on its genetics. So if it's got really rare genetics, It's, you know, quite unrelated to other individuals. Its lineage is not very well represented. We actually have a scoring system of gold, silver, bronze, and we have chalk as the lowest one. So if it's a gold chick, it gets checked every night. If it's a chalk chick, it gets checked every week. So, and the reason we do that is because the kakapo conservation is really intensive. I could not believe when I first joined the program how intensive it is. It's probably one of the most intensively managed species in the wild, in the world, I would say. But that's not sustainable in the long term. And so one of the things that we have to do is step back, and we try each breeding season to really, really make an effort to do that. And one of the ways of stepping back is, well, you don't treat all birds equally. And you cannot continue, as the population grows, to check every chick every night. We have to, you know, take some steps to reduce that intensity. And so that's what we're doing here, to try and find a way to do that in a structured way, which kind of makes sense from a population point of view.
Yeah, it does. It sounds a little bit mercenary at the start, but it must be so intensive for the gold chicks and for, you can't do everything.
Yeah, exactly. Sense. Yeah, and we base it on other things as well, as like their weight and how they're doing, for example. So if a chick looks like it's doing quite well, then we won't check it for a few nights, for example.
Yeah,
we're also mindful of the fact that every time we check a chick and we interact with kakapo, we might be having some impact that we're not aware of. So, so it's important to try and keep things as natural as possible. So the idea is to give as light a touch as possible, but not so light that birds die. So, yeah, striking that balance.
Tell me about lek mating.
Yeah, so lek mating is kakapo, the only parrot species which lek mate, and that basically is a group mating system. Lek means play in Swedish, actually. And so what happens with kakapo is that the males congregate in certain areas and they display to the females. They basically have a singing competition. And then the females, there's a female choice mating system. So the females basically go around all the males, choose the one that they like, and then they'll mate with them. And sometimes they mate with more than one male, but they'll often visit lots of males and for whatever reason decide they don't like that one. They'll go to this other one over there. So yeah, that's how they mate. It means that we can't really control it that much. So from a conservation management point of view, it's interesting, but it's an interesting mating system, and it's kind of crazy to be on a kakapo island in a breeding season and hear all the males booming. And
it must be loud. Yeah,
it is loud, and they can get quite aggressive too. Like a few times I've had a male come booming and come running at you, to try and chase you off his display site because they defend it against other kakapo.
Oh, because you're a threat.
They don't like anyone being there. So yeah, when they run and boom at the same time, it sounds quite weird. So yeah, it's quite an unusual sound.
Wow. Let's talk about disease, another big thing for kakapo. A few years ago, there was a big aspergillosis outbreak during breeding season. Can you give us a bit of an overview of that?
Yeah, so just so briefly on that, it's aspergillosis is a fungal pneumonia. It affects humans too. It's a big human health problem. We hadn't really had much of a problem in it with kakapo before, only one case. But in 2019, we had a big outbreak in a breeding season affecting females and chicks. We had 21 individuals affected, 9 died as a result of that. It was a huge effort. We ended up flying just over 50 kakapo off the islands to hospitals, including human hospitals, to get them CT scanned. And pretty much most of the vets in New Zealand, the wildlife vets, helped and pitched in. We had a big response internationally as well to try and understand what caused this. It was a pretty massive task. And in fact, we actually had a small aspergillosis outbreak in 2022, the following breeding season too. But it was on a smaller scale. So it's definitely a problem. It seems to be possibly a growing problem. We're trying to understand a bit more about what causes it and whether our management is even implicated in some way. And because there's some really unusual things we found out about the type of fungus which caused this. So yeah, it's an ongoing research, but definitely disease is one of those things that it's a real concern for kakapo and for any critically endangered species where you've only got a few individuals.
Look forward to hearing how that goes. Now, aspergillosis was a new term for kakapo lovers, but there's another disease with a name that's much more straightforward. At the risk of asking you to state the obvious, Dr. Digby, what's crusty butt?
Crusty bum, cloacitis. Yeah, it kind of does what it says on the tin. It's basically you get these ulcerations and sores around the cloaca of the kakapo. So that's where the kakapo poos out of, basically. So, and that's the all-purpose hole for birds, for mating and for pooing. So this is actually a disease which has caused us quite a lot of problems. It started in 2002, the first time we noticed it. So it's been going on for more than 20 years. And it's affected quite a lot of the kakapo. We're over 40 cases of cloacitis now, and about half of those have actually happened in the last 3 years. So it's accelerating. But we don't know what causes it. We don't know if it's a virus, if it's a bacteria, if it's something like an autoimmune disease, like some inflammatory bowel disease in human, for example. So it's a we've been doing a lot of research, and we're still doing some research at the moment to try and understand what causes it. And then once we know what causes it, we can try and mitigate it a bit. We can treat it. So if an individual gets, if we find an individual with it, we can treat it. We normally send them to hospital. Sometimes we can treat them on the islands, but we can treat it sort of topically and give them some treatment on islands and they recover. We've probably had some individuals die from it. So it would be fatal left unchecked, but yeah, it's one of those things which is causing us quite a few headaches in terms of management, for example, quarantining and that sort of thing.
Mm. Are kakapo just more susceptible to disease than other birds, or do you just notice the impacts because there are only so many of them?
It might be that they're more susceptible because of their genetic issues. Their low genetic variation could possibly make them more susceptible. So if you have individuals which are very closely related, then you could get a disease come along which wipes, you know, most of the population out. That's something you have to be really careful about with small populations. It might also be because we monitor them quite closely that, you know, we know other birds do get sick too. But I think it's partly the fact that when you've got so much a small population, you know, even a few disease cases can have a big impact on the size of that population and the impacts. So I think that's part of it too.
Yeah. And what are we doing to kind of mitigate this?
Yeah, we monitor kakapo pretty closely. Each kakapo has got its activity tracker, pretty much its own Fitbit, and we can monitor those remotely. So I could log on now and just look online and see what the activity of kakapo has been. So if a kakapo gets sick, we can see a drop in activity and then we can intervene. And with things like avian influenza on the horizon, you know, that's been causing devastation around the world. It hasn't hit New Zealand yet, but it's definitely something that we're preparing for and readying ourselves for in case it comes to New Zealand. And, you know, with a disease like that, you could easily lose, you know, half a population and half a species, even if you've got a small number of birds. So, yeah, we have to be pretty vigilant about that sort of thing.
It's like having all your eggs in one basket and how dangerous that can be, I guess. I love that kakapo have Fitbits, essentially. That's kakapo tech is such a fascinating world. Can we talk a bit about gene sequencing? What is that?
So, yeah, the gene sequencing started back in 2015 when a group in the United States sequenced the genome of the kakapo for the first time. So that's basically picking one individual and sequencing all of the genes of that individual. So you get a complete map of the genes on that particular individual. But at the time for kakapo, there was only 125 kakapo in existence. So we thought if we've done one, maybe we can do all of them. Let's do all 125 of them and get all of the genomes for all of the kakapo. And the reason we wanted to do that is because kakapo are managed really individually. Like every kakapo has got its name. Every kakapo has its own transmitter. Every kakapo has its own feed station. We have individual behaviors that we know about. We treat that, we manage them separately. So having genetic information on top of that for each individual is a natural progression. So we started a program to do that. We sequenced all 125. We have, the population's grown since then, and we've now actually got nearly 350 kakapo genomes. So that's all of the living birds and quite a few of the dead ones too. And I think that's probably the most comprehensive gene library of any species in the world, I think. So that's an amazing resource that we have. And we've opened that up to anyone around the world who wants to use those data to research. And particularly we're keen on how can that genetic data teach us some of the things that are problems for kakapo. So things like infertility, for example, and disease. How can we use those genetic data to understand those problems?
Wow. And did the gene sequencing of every living kakapo help you make conservation decisions going forward?
Yes, it has. So we're already using that information for things like translocation for artificial insemination. We now are developing some tools with the help of researchers at Genomics Aotearoa at the University of Otago and elsewhere to provide tools to understand things like how heavy should a chick be at certain stages in its growth, based on its genetics, based on who its parents are. So we kind of have a bit of a template to be able to use this genetic information to help guide the management in a practical sort of sense on the ground.
Oh, I love science. That's fantastic. Can you tell me a bit about the research into ancient diets of kakapo? How do you know what they used to eat?
Yeah, so I guess this comes back down to poo, and you'd be kind of surprised about how often poo is useful in conservation. We have a lot of conversations about poo. And so this is actually really interesting, because one of the things about kakapos, we have a little bit of an artificial situation. We have a remnant population. We don't know what's natural. But by looking at things like fossilized poo from hundreds or thousands of years ago, we can understand more about what they ate, where they lived, what they bred in response to. And some work done by researchers at Manaaki Whenua and Landcare researchers has done this and taught us quite a few things, for example, about the importance of beech trees and beech forest ecosystems to kakapo breeding. And that's something we just don't see. We have not seen kakapo breeding in response to beech in the modern era, but it's actually really important because there's a lot of good beech habitat in New Zealand. And if we can identify that and be sure that that's a good habitat for kakapo, that suddenly opens up more possibilities for where we can put them.
Those are some of the fascinating innovations, and there are also some that sound highly questionable. Could you tell us about the spermcopter?
The spermcopter. Yeah, so the spermcopter is actually something which I think kind of worked, and it has a reason. So we do artificial insemination in kakapo, and one of the problems when you do artificial insemination is that you need to get the sperm from the male to the female as quickly as possible, because then you have a greater chance of success. And the problem with kakapo is that often they will be up trees and they will often be on different sides of an island. So it might take, say, an hour and a half or so to get from the male to the female if you're walking. And so we were starting to do some work with drones, and we thought, well, how about we fly the sperm from the male to the female? And we worked out that we could fly what would normally take an hour and a half to walk in about 8 minutes. And so we did that in 2019 breeding season. So we basically bought a commercial drone and just adapted it slightly and put a little container on it. And so we flew the sperm from the male across the island to the female to get it there much more quickly. So yeah, that's kind of the sort of thing that we always try and think a little bit outside the box in the program and do some crazy things. And you might have seen things like the kakapo helmet, for example. So yeah, there's always things like that. And some things work, some things don't. But you know, you've got to be bold and try these things sometimes.
That's brilliant. That is real number eight wire thinking. Oh, I love that idea.
As you've just heard there, Andrew has so many brilliant stories that we decided to split his episode into two parts. In part two, he answers some questions sent in by you, our wonderful listeners. We also delve into some of kakapo conservation's biggest wins, as well as the biggest disappointments, the challenges, and the continuous learning from managing such an intriguing and unusual species. You won't want to miss this.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Erica Wilkinson, and this has been the Doc Sounds of Science podcast. This show is available wherever you get your podcasts, or you can stream it off our website, doc.govt.nz. This show is produced by Jane Ramage, with editing by Lucy Holyoake. If you enjoyed this episode, show us some love with a 5-star rating.